goodness, guys. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, even though I've had to jump through a new set of hurdles for Blog Talk Radio. I was just about
to give you kudos for opening up on time. What do you guys think? I thought it was tremendous.
Tremendous. Oh, my goodness. Every time I log in to Blog Talk Radio, they've changed the homepage. They've changed the studio. They've changed the...
I know. It's ridiculous.
And this time, because they changed the host call-in number to a 213 number, and I haven't written that down, so I don't have that number memorized. I had the old number memorized. They changed it, and they wouldn't display the number on my screen. The only thing it would display, if you're using our Hi-Fi service, make sure your reload your audio files. And that's what kept on appearing, but never the call-in numbers.
That's lovely. How did you decode that mess?
I hit refresh on two different computers about 20 different times, and then finally on one computer it says, okay, if you're trying to call into the show, here's the number. And it came down in a pop-up menu in the middle of one of the two pages on the two computers.
Well, I can tell you, I've always felt inept trying to set it up when it never changed. So I wouldn't have stood a chance. That's for sure.
Good. Yeah, in fact, the other one has an ad right now after having tried to line the thing up about 20 different times, 40 times considering both computers. That's an ad for Gold Peak iced tea instead of the show. So I just don't know, man.
I'm gonna guess they didn't get lucky. You didn't buy one, you know. But
No. But goodness, it just every time it's a series of new hurdles. I don't know how many of you have been listening to Kirk and I go through an interesting passage. It's a discussion that Yahweh is having with us through Yeshayah. It's in the 28th chapter of Yeshayah, and it is yet another incriminating prophecy of specifically about Christianity and Paul. And
I have not had the opportunity to read it. Is it in Yeshayah or no?
No, it's not. It's something that I've done my translation of the first five or six statements. We've got to get to about 18 or 19 before we hear Yahweh call out Shaul by name in this. But thus far, it has been so interesting that I thought we'd go over it here again on this program. For some of you that's listened to Yahweh, this will be a bit redundant, but as we talk today, redundancy is really helpful.
If you could shoot me over and if you could email me that, I'd appreciate it.
I would be happy to do so.
Well, you're the man. Can I say something real quick before we start? I did listen to you and Kirk, and specifically Kirk was the genius that brought this up. And he was pointing out that in fact, there's only one way to get to the covenant, something you said many times. But he pointed out, you know, that Adam, and by the way, I've had Scott do this too, Adam and Noah and Anakin and Abraham were not Jewish. They were not Yehudim. They were not Yisrael. They were, in fact, Gentiles. And I thought that was, you know, I have to go back in shows because I'm very busy these days and, you know, catch them as I can, and I'm kind of up to that point. And I just thought it was a pretty amazing show right there. I really enjoyed that. And I just want to say thanks for putting that out there. Very nice work.
That was all Kirk. And what Kirk did is just by thinking through this whole process of Pauline Christianity, where Paul said, all right, the disciples that Yosha chose, even though this is totally contrary to all everything Yahweh said and everything Yosha said to them, and everything that they did, that the world was divided, and that Paul had exclusive domain over the world, while they had only the opportunity to speak to the circumcised, which would be Yisrael, what Kirk mentioned, which is profound, is that the covenant was not established with Yisrael.
No.
Was established.
Well, they were the control group, as you've always said. The control group.
Later on. later on.
Yeah, and well, I mean, it does get sad when you're looking at messianics and rabbinics go on about our Torah. Well, first of all, Yahweh doesn't even recognize your Torah. He says so in Malachi.
Right.
It's just your Torah is nothing. It's destroyed everything. It's right. Yahweh's Torah that he's interested in. You know, the one where they actually use his name and are proud of it.
Yeah.
And so, I just thought that was it was very nice. It was
what Yahweh was doing is reaching out to Babylonians, so to ethnicities, to people who are not Jewish. Not Yehudim, reaching out to two Babylonians and calling them out of Babylon into the Promised Land, which means that his covenant message is for those of us who were born wherever we were born, no matter where we were born, no matter what culture we were born into, so long as we're willing to walk away from it and walk through the Promised Land in accord with Yahweh's instructions, the covenant is for us. The covenant wasn't for Jews. Abraham wasn't a Jew. Abraham was a Babylonian. Sarah was a Babylonian. Now, they were Babylonians. Both of them left Babylon. And so long as we as Americans are Great Britainers, as the English or Kiwis or Australians, so long as we leave, disassociate ourselves.
Yeah, be careful about those Kiwis, especially David,
that's right. But so long as we disassociate from nationalism and politics and religion, we're welcome in the covenant, just as Abraham was as a former Babylonian. And so, the difference was that rather than reaching out and communicating a message to the world, which is what Yahweh did, encouraging those who were interested in knowing him and engaging in a relationship with him, leaving the world of Babylon and coming to his family, Paul instead divided the world and took those that believed him back to Babylon.
Yeah, but wouldn't that fit? That would fit rabbinic Judaism too perfectly, which is really where he was trained. It reminds me of the people that Eliyahu. When he did the with all the priests, when he showed them that their God, who was apparently asleep on the job, couldn't do this, and Yahweh could, at that point, all these people fell down and worshipped. So, from their perspective, and this would be, I'm making an analogy here for the rabbinic perspective. The rabbinic perspective is that this is our God, and these are our laws. And all the stuff that isn't true. There's only one God, and He's God who created everything.
It is their God. It's also you and my God. He is the only God.
Yeah, but
and,
I mean,
it is their Torah, so long as they're looking at the right Torah, and it is our Torah because there's only one Torah. All of that is really quite profound when you think about it. Paul was attempting to do the very opposite of what Yahweh was doing. And
which was hoping that Yehudim would show the rest of us how to live.
later, as Abraham and Sarah have Yishak laughter and define the purpose of the covenant, which is to have fun, to enjoy one's offspring, to enjoy one's children, to laugh together. Then they have Yaakov, the one who digs in his heel, who doesn't waver, who's not going to be associated with religion or politics or any false doctrines, and he becomes Yisrael, those who engage and endure with God. That during that process, Yahweh creates, makes a promise, and he demonstrates via the control group that became Yisrael the benefits of accepting the terms and conditions of the covenant and being part of his family, and of rejecting them, even of ignoring them. And he shows examples.
You could die in a flood as an example. Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
For the most part, Yahudah ignored them. Ephraim, however, did not ignore them. They rejected them. And so Ephraim became a very special case. And in Hosea, Ephraim is the principal subject of the entire book of Hosea. And the purpose of the discussion of Ephraim is to place Ephraim as Gomer. Gomer was a temple prostitute. She was a whore. And she was a religious whore. And Yahweh wanted to equate what the northern tribes had become, Ephraim, 10 of the 12 tribes, and ultimately it became 11 of the 12 tribes when Benjamin opposed and went out openly against Yehuda. But he wanted to
demonstrate... The tribe that Paul's from. Yeah.
Right, that's correct. That he wanted to demonstrate through Ephraim that religious opposition, religious harlotry, being a prostitute and having an adulterous relationship with false gods, that those who do those things are estranged from him. They are, in Yahweh's words, not my children. And he repeats that over and over in Hosea. Speaking of Ephraim, he says, you are not my children. And then he says, I am divorcing you because you have rejected the terms and conditions of my covenant. And therefore, I am divorcing you for infidelity. And so what we see in Ephraim, and all we should think about it, Ephraim, we shouldn't think of Northern Kingdom, unless we understand the Northern Kingdom. We shouldn't think about a son of one of the patriarchs of the covenant, unless we understand the nature of that son. What we should see is the way that Yahweh uses Ephraim in Hosea, primarily, and secondarily in Yashaya, Isaiah.
To say what not to be.
Yeah. Yes. He has a singular mindset towards Ephraim. He says, you're religious. You're chasing after all manner of gods. You know, you've got all sorts of religious icons and religious rituals that dominate your culture. And for that reason, I have nothing to do with you. You're not my children. You've violated the covenant, and I'm rejecting you.
Right.
So Ephraim is the poster child for religion. And as
what
such,
not to be.
And as such, Yahweh's ultimate frustration, with the thing that Yahweh dislikes the most and absolutely, unequivocally, in all circumstances, causes you to be disassociated from it. You know, what happened with the children of Israel during the Exodus when Aaron said, let's make an altar because tomorrow is one of the festival feasts of Yahweh. And they made their own version of Yahweh by way of the Egyptian golden calf. And Yahweh say, oh, that's okay, you know, I know what you really mean. Just because you have a different image and a different name, it's no big deal to me. It's all cool. You know, I'm an open-minded God.
Doing the best you can.
Yeah, you're doing the best you can. I know it's not what it means to you. And we're just all going to get along.
Can I throw something in here? I mean, just
nope.
Do you mind?
Sure.
Okay. And this is kind of a bridge from Yashaya into Hosea. And this is one of my favorite passages, as we all know. This is the one that tells you Yahweh, along with another, is not a religious deity besides the entire book itself. Then Yahweh said, for so much as these people approach me with their mouths and their lip service, they have removed their hearts from me. Their fear, Yirah, toward me exists because it is taught out of man-made notions, learned by rote. Okay, so now we got to figure out where the idea of the conceptualization that relationship should be a fearful one comes from. And here it is. When Ephraim spoke, there was trembling and terror. And this is now in Hosea 31:10. He exalted himself to Yisrael, but with the Lord Baal. He was wrong, offensive, trespassing where he did not belong, and he died. I have a note about that for people that enjoy hearing God.
Can you give me the specific passage, that one? I know it's from one of the
Hosea 13:1. I'm sorry, 13:1.
All right. Yep. Because I want to have you read that again, and then I'm going to read the statement in Yashaya. Because Hosea 13:1 explains why Yahweh used Ephraim in this passage. So Ephraim was guilty of the following things. Go ahead and read that passage again, Larry.
When Ephraim spoke, there was trembling and terror. He exalted himself in Yisrael, but with the Lord Baal. He was wrong and offensive, trespassing where he didn't belong, and died.
Okay, so this begins with woe. Oi. Woe, as we talked in the Shattering Mist program, conveys three essential components. The first is, this is God providing a warning. Second, this warning is about something that is really bad, that is very deadly, destructive to your soul. So, I'm providing a warning, and what I'm talking about here is not trivial. This is extraordinarily bad. This is really, really deadly, what I'm talking about here. This is important for you to understand because it is so deplorable.
So deplorable.
And the third aspect of woe is, oi, is that the reason that this warning is being issued, the reason that this deplorable state exists, is that because people have become ignorant, that they lack understanding, and as a result of act of understanding, delusion has become prevalent. Now, compare that to Hosea, where Yahweh says, "Thy people are destroyed for lack of understanding." All right, so this warning, this woe is being made to a group of people, a nation or time, a population that lacks understanding, and that delusion has become prevalent. And the lack of understanding is extreme, and that they're doing things that are extraordinarily offensive to God. And God's saying, you know, I'm going to warn you about it. So those are the three aspects of woe. Kirk, we talked about this in the show this morning and yesterday. Does Yahweh ever issue a prophetic woe or warning if it's something that you and I individually are doing that is irritating?
No, he really doesn't sweat the small stuff. This is big stuff. This is death.
This is
eternal.
Stuff.
Death right. Eternal.
So, by big stuff, and if we're dealing with societal-wide stuff, what is there that would be big stuff other than religion, politics, societal norms, patriotism, militarism? What else is there?
Academia. Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah.
It covers it all.
Yeah. So, this is a warning regarding those things. And did the definition of Ephraim, Larry, mention arrogance?
Let's hang on here a second. Ephraim, fruit which turns to ashes. Yeah, that only happens out of arrogance if you're a person. Sure.
Well, Ephraim actually means heap of ashes. But the passage that you read regarding Ephraim specifically stated that Ephraim was arrogant.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
That it was arrogant. The second word of Yashaya 28:1 is, woe to the arrogant and conceited. The self.
Yeah, he exalted himself. Yeah, that's right. Not so. Yeah, that's arrogant.
So exalting oneself is unwarranted authority and adulation and exaltation, which is what the word geoth means. But didn't it also say he was wrong?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, he was wrong.
A sham.
To be presumptive, right, to be presumptive means that you're presuming that you have authority that you do not have. That would be wrong. Kirk, how much authority do you have with God?
Zip.
Yeah, it's the same amount that I have. Absolutely none.
We're all
I don't
there.
Have, and you, how much authority would you like to have with God, Kirk?
Zip. I'm happy with none.
Yeah, in fact, I would prefer none. I don't want any authority. I don't want any responsibility. I love the way that he's established the government. He's
well,
got all authority. He's got all responsibility. I've just got enjoyment.
That's right.
That's right.
I'm happy being independent.
Yeah, I'm happy too. I'm normally not happy being a dependent because I'm a self, motivated sort of a guy. But I'm going to tell you, I'm happy in this case being a dependent.
Wait a minute, you're a self-motivated kind of guy?
Yeah, I am. Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, probably not. So
I'm kidding.
It says that woes are presumptive, which means making an assumption that is not true, arrogant and conceited, self-important, with unwarranted claims of authority, a moral failure, agitating, using smoke, which is a smoke screen, and of self-adulation and exaltation, falsely claiming the authority and majesty of God.
That would be true religion, then.
That sounds like the very definition of Ephraim. Yeah. By the way, I know another guy that made a claim to being God's being an apostle, being chosen by God, being taught by God, meeting God on the road to Damascus, and taking the authority of the disciples, claiming it for himself, and claiming that God gave him sole authority to preach to the world. Do you know a guy like that?
Yeah, sure. I know of a guy like that,
a
murdering homosexual rabbi that enjoyed looking at other men's genitals, according to him.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it was opposed to circumcision that arrived at the time the Moed were being fulfilled. We're now going to what Yahweh said. You're not being pejorative. You're not saying anything that Yahweh did not say in the book of Chabaouk. Embrace this. Okay, so the first statement is, woe to the presumptive and arrogant, the self-aggrandizing, if you will, those who claim God's authority.
Mm-hmm.
The second word, the third word here is Acheron. Translate Acheron a number of different ways. It's a really unique Hebrew word. It's not used much apart from Yashaya. It could mean those who claim victory. You know, the Roman emperors, the Roman popes were always claiming victory for themselves. The Council of Nicaea was named after the goddess of victory, Nike. The crown was worn not only by political authority, but by religious authority. They all had their little fancy hats. And so it's by religious and political authority. So the arrogance and presumptive nature of those who claim political and religious authority. Does any place we read about Dode and him having a fancy crown?
None that I recall.
I don't recall one either. Did Yosha ever have a fancy crown? Did he walk around with a crown?
Yosha.
If Yosha wanted to walk around with a crown, would he have been appropriate in doing so?
Absolutely.
But he didn't, did he?
No.
I know somebody that walked around with a crown, though. It was King Shaul, King Saul. Mm-hmm. And I know a guy that claimed that he had a crown, and that was Shaul, Paul. He said that those in Philippians, that those who believed him were his crown. They were his crown. So the crown here is human leadership and institutionalized leadership. Institutionalized leadership, because last time I checked, most dads that might consider themselves head of household don't wear a crown at home. Most moms who would be the queen of the castle don't wear crowns at home. The only people that wear crowns are military, they got their fancy hats. Religious authorities, they got their fancy hats. And political authorities, they've got their fancy hats. Those are the three people that wear crowns. And since this crown is circular, it's like a wreath, it is circular. The crown is also equivalent to what rabbis wore and still wear, the yarmulke. So it's the Yahweh doesn't like these circular headwear that is a sign of leadership and religious authority. And the word here means round. Atra means round. And so I know another word that means round. It's called circle. And Larry, do you know what the English word circle is based on?
The daughter of Helios, the sun god, Circe.
Right. Circe. Yeah. And what English word is transliterated from her name?
Circle would be one of them from the room. Yeah.
Yeah. How about a religious
circus would be another.
Oh yeah, circus would be another. Circle would be another. Is there a religious word that is derived from a church name?
Yeah, that'd be church.
Oh, church. Church, yeah. So Yahweh's not very fond of church here either.
Yeah. All right. Circles in general don't work out that very well. Matter of fact, I think when Shimon was talking about Sheol's letters, what he said about them was that they talked in circles.
They talked in circles.
Reasoning.
Yeah. Circular reasoning. Yeah, it's not very fond of that.
Circular,
that,
I should say.
Yahweh has a lot of symbols. Bread is a symbol. Is it baked in a circle, or is that the Babylonian interpretation?
That would be the Babylonian, the thing that they do for matzah when we're not to have leavened bread. They have the hot cross buns, which is
a circle
with a cross on them.
Yeah, the Christian version and the Catholic version. Okay, what about the menorah versus the Babylonian wax candle? The wax candle's round, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is.
Is the menorah round?
No.
No, it isn't, is it? The symbols. Light. Can you equate light to round? I don't think so. Yahweh symbols. Water? Yeah. Water round? No, not really. Yahweh symbols are, he never uses round, circle as a symbol, but religion sure as heck does. All right, then he says of this crown, this religious leadership, this presumptive and arrogant religious leadership, that it is intoxicated. Now, do you think he's speaking of alcohol here?
No. No, anytime he talks about intoxication, he's talking about men with power. Actually, men abusing power. I mean, always.
Yeah, and deceiving others, deluding others.
Like religious clerics.
Right. Political correctness has all of the effect of a toxin, of intoxicating people today. Because, being intoxicated, yeah, we use the symbol because all the way back 5,000 years ago, people understood that if you drank too much wine or beer, that your judgment was impaired and that your response time was delayed. And since the covenant is based on being able to exercise good judgment and processing the information that Yahweh has provided and to respond to him, alcohol is synonymous with the things that impair our ability to exercise good judgment and to respond appropriately.
Wait a minute. I thought we were not to judge.
I don't recall him ever saying that. I heard him, don't separate, krino, lest you be separated, but he didn't use krino, of course. He used, he spoke in Hebrew. But what we have then is intoxication, which is because, as a result of, really, impaired judgment, of the inability to be thoughtful and rational. That's, there's a reason that you're cited for driving a car under the influence. What is that reason? Why can't you just drive a car under the influence?
Because of your lack of judgment skills at that moment.
Yes, and inability to respond appropriately. Correct?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, right. So Yahweh says that as an inability to respond and an inability to exercise good judgment, this is the problem. When you talk to a religious person today, do you find them rational?
Never.
No. When you share Yahweh's testimony and Yahweh speaks out against their religion, does it resonate with them? Can they process it?
Not at all.
When you present the terms and conditions of the covenant, did they respond?
No.
So they're intoxicated.
Yeah, they don't even know what it means.
Right. In political correctness today, socialist secular humanism, the intoxicating effect of it is that people are indoctrinated such that they cease to exercise good judgment. They're no longer discerning. If you're not discerning, there is no way you're ever going to know and understand Yahweh. If you can't exercise good judgment, you are never going to be part of the covenant. So,
can I give you an example? Can I give you a great example of that? There was a fellow here on FB, and he's got quite a group that gets on his page and stuff, and he's fairly new, and he's fairly receptive to Yahweh's words. He really seems to be. I finally blocked him because I just couldn't take all these stupid Hallmark moments that were being posted on his page, but that's another issue. But he was using the term fear. Now, I took Yasha Yahu, 29:12-13, the one that talked about fear existing only because it's a man-made notion learned by reciting garbage. Yeah. And then I put Ephraim right under that shows where fear comes from. And he said, well, it says right here in Strong's, Yira is fear. I said, it can mean either or, but your religious copy editors always take the low road. I said, Yahweh just told you where fear comes from. He says, well, from now on, rather than make the choice of respect vice fear, he says, I'll just write Yira. Is that the word I use? And I left.
Yeah.
If you don't get that, if you're so afraid to make a decision that your tradition might step on what Yahweh just said, if you can't delineate that much, I don't want to spend an hour with you, much less an eternity.
Now, the next word here, the fifth word in this statement, after woe, this is a warning about something that's really bad. And the second word, geuth, meaning that which is presumptive and conceited about people exalting themselves. And the third word being atral, which is this human institutionalized leadership, which is intoxicating, which therefore, shakor, diminishes our ability to exercise good judgment and to respond. The next word is Ephraim.
Ephraim.
Yeah, Ephraim. Sure. So what did Ephraim cause in the land, in the passage that you cited?
Fear. And he
fear.
Goes through Lord Baal. He goes through Lord Baal, period.
Yeah, so he imposed fear as a result of the Lord. Fear the Lord. Yeah. By the way, you know, if you are not part of Yahweh's family, should you fear? You better. Yeah. If you're spending eternity with him, he's not a nice guy. You better. And this idea of religion. When you go by a billboard of a Texas Baptist church, is the sign that you're most likely to see, you know, you think it's hot here, it's hotter still in hell. This idea that if you don't acquiesce to their religion, if you don't put something that folds in the collection bowl and attend their church, that you're going to roast in hell, and you ought to be afraid of that.
Yeah, we're talking fire and brimstone here.
Right.
It's bad news. Yeah.
Right.
Dante
and
Tell is alive and well.
You know the truth, and as a result of speaking against Allah, you know, he's going to torment you forever in hell. Fear. Fear is the driving force of religion. People are afraid of death. They're afraid of hell. They're afraid of just everything under the sun. And so religion provides them a sense of comfort.
May I say that politics, military, economic, academic, patriotism all work operate on the same thing?
Sure. What happens, Kirk, if there's playing? You're in a stadium, particularly in the state of Texas, but you're in a stadium anywhere the Bible Belt, and they start playing the national anthem, and you leave your hat on and you stay seated.
Mm-hmm.
How are you? How are you?
Fight somebody between there and the bathroom.
You better.
You know.
Yeah, right.
I have to go get a hot dog. You know, during.
Yeah, what I do is I know before they begin all of that I'm going to get up and I'm going to go to the camp. That's my protest. I just figured, you know, I don't want to have to fight anybody, but the last thing I'm going to do is stand and do the national anthem. So, but it's fear. You know, if you are not politically correct and therefore dishonest, inaccurate as part of the media. Should you fear losing your job?
Absolutely, you should.
Yeah, absolutely. You're going to lose it. And so fear is the driving force. What does the military want you to consider that? Which, if you're looking at the police and the military and you're considering doing something they don't want you to do, are you afraid?
Try to frighten you to death if they can.
Right, right. You know, the death penalty, doesn't that exist to motivate people out of fear not to commit crime?
Mm-hmm. Well,
isn't jail? Yeah, isn't jail a means of instilling fear as a consequence of crime? Fear?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if Yahweh were to say, love me or I will see to it that you're tortured in hell, he would be fearsome. He would also be demonic.
Unlovable, too.
Unlovable. And so all of those concepts are the stuff of religion. And so when he says that the intoxication of Ephraim, when you consider how he defined Ephraim as being someone in concert with the Lord, who is Satan, Baal, who instills fear, which is the basis of religion, and who was wrong about something very important, which is therefore in conflict with Yahweh's testimony, and is dead, which means that they have been estranged from the source of life. It's hard to miss the fact that Ephraim is being used as religion, institutionalized religion. So woe to the presumptiveness and the arrogance of the leadership of the intoxicating of institutionalized religion of Ephraim.
When did we put alcohol together with this calling it spirit?
Well, you know, the
because it's
alcohol,
a great fit.
Yeah, alcohol has a very low boiling point. The thing about alcohol that's unusual is that it migrates from liquid to gas at a very low temperature. And so when you brew alcohol, you are subject to the gases of the alcohol, and air that is not coming from inside of you. Air that comes from inside of you, your breath, is synonymous with nefesh, the soul. Because when you're breathing, you're alive, you have consciousness. But the spirit is associated with air that is moving from without, and the transition from liquid alcohol to the vapor form, the gaseous form, is so prevalent. It can be smelled, it can be sensed in your eyes, in your nose, in your mouth. It is the only liquid that was common throughout human history that you could associate with a gas because of the nature of alcohol and how it vaporizes, turns into gas at a very low temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is that there are two spirits. There's a spirit that's associated with olives and water, healing, life-giving, enlightening, and a spirit that is associated with alcohol, intoxication, because alcohol confuses, it diminishes judgment, and so there are two spirits, one spirit, that of Hasatan and his demons, and it's always associated with intoxication, just as Babel, confusion, is associated with Babylon. So it's a metaphor that Yahweh has used throughout the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. I think it's a really astute metaphor because of the consequence and nature of alcohol.
Yeah, well, he even uses that in Chabahuk, right? I mean, he talks about this intoxicating spirit.
Right. He does. It's an intoxicating spirit. Yeah, so religion intoxicates. It impairs judgment. It renders...
He calls it his house, too, so we know that's a religion. So when he's talking about intoxicating spirits, you know, he's not talking about you having some... sipping whiskey. not what it's about.
No. This is not about, you know, this is not the Baptist thing. You shouldn't have a glass of wine. I had a glass of wine with dinner. I, no, uh, no guilt associated with the glass of wine for dinner. Last time I checked, Yahweh rather likes wine as a symbol. And wine is very often used as something that he makes and drinks and celebrates. And we're going to have wine in eternity. I rather like
that. Yahusha's first miracle.
Yeah, Yahusha's first miracle, turning water into wine. And in Pesach, he talks about the wine representing the blood shed by the sacrificial lamb, the Passover lamb. So nothing wrong with wine. Being drunk, which is to be intoxicated, is bad, because Yahweh is all about the business of us coming to know and understand, of us exercising our nesama and therefore exercising good judgment. Religion exists on is predicated upon the idea that we do not exercise good judgment. That we believe, as opposed to know and understand. That's why it's intoxicating.
Yeah, and you said, you know, obviously the Moed Mikra are there for the purposes of understanding. It's not for any other purpose. You know, I mean, that's
correct.
What it's for.
Right.
And you know, we get to levels of understanding more and more. It's like peeling an onion. But to give you an idea how fouled up that can get, there was a fellow that, you know, he was making Pesach staffs. And so I bought one. You know, it's got Yahweh's name on it, and Yahusha's name on it. And I said, you know, because part of it was, you know, to sit there with your staff. And I said, now I've got the upright pole while I eat. You know, I mean, it's pretty clear what's going on with, you know, that upright pole in your hand. And the very fellow that made this, that, you know, I've kind of distanced myself, well, I've totally distanced myself from him. Uses words like obey and command and law all day long in faith. And so I corrected him 10 times and said, we'll no longer be affiliated. But here's a guy making Pesach staffs and has no understanding of what that staff is. He said, wow, I never knew that. Never thought of that. I thought, wow, that's brilliant.
If you do not think, you cannot know. If you do not make the connections as you're doing and seek to understand those connections, there is zero possibility of ever being part of the covenant. So having a flawed ability to exercise good judgment is lethal. That's what I said. My people are destroyed for their lack of understanding. Intoxication is the broad-based beings that religious and political and patriotic men and women have used throughout the centuries to render the masses ignorant so that they just simply go along. Just the bottom line of all this. So Yahweh has been blunt. Those words are straightforward. There is no missing them. So long as you take the time to make the connections, that you understand why he used Ephraim. Because Ephraim, you know, by this time, by the time of Yahshua, Ephraim's essentially gone. The Assyrians have 86 Ephraim.
And so right there, they were dead.
Right. No,
they're dead.
Well,
spiritually.
Hosha, in defining Ephraim, is, I think Hosha is slightly before Yahshua.
Yeah, he led them out.
Is way after Yahshua. You know,
yep.
So, you know, in terms of the order of things, it's Hosha, Yahshua, and then Chabaouk. So, all the way, you know, already in Hosha, Ephraim is dead. So, Yahweh's not, at this point, he's not concerned about Ephraim. He's not talking to you about Ephraim. He's not talking about an individual. He's not talking about part of a nation. Talking about a religious and political mindset that he finds disgusting. You know, what did he say to Ephraim? He said, I'm divorcing myself from you because of infidelity, because you have chased after false gods. You are not my children. I mean, how do you get more blunt than that?
Yeah, they worshipped the same god Christians do, Lord Baal. They called him
Lord Baal. They're the Lord. He called them not my children. That was the name he gave to them, is not my children. Yahweh wasn't accommodating. He wasn't all loving. He didn't say, let all the little children come to me. No.
As long as your heart is prepared and you did this all by accident and you took part in Christmas and Easter, it's okay. We love you.
No, you are not my children. And as I shared with Kirk today, that there is an aspect of Ephraim that I thought was really enticing, which is that Yahweh could have used his favorite term for the religious mindset. You know what his favorite term is for religious mindset? It's not Ephraim. What's the most prevalent? What's the thing that he asked
Babylon,
Abram to walk away from?
Babylon, yeah.
Yeah, Babylon, confusion. Mm-hmm. He didn't use Babel here, did he?
No.
Why did he choose Ephraim instead of Babel here?
Well, we discussed it, but going to instead of coming from, I mean, this is, they were part of the family already.
Yes.
And left.
They walked right out of it.
Walked right out of the fire. Yeah, they walked straight out of all of the benefits of the covenant inheritance and walked away from it.
And you know, way back in Yahshael, you know, when they were talking about, what is it, Chronicles or things, you know, where, you know, the foreshadowing of reconciliations of Kippur.
Right.
Where did they have to go out and destroy Ishtar vestiges or Asherah vestiges, Easter vestiges? It was out there in the land of Ephraim, wasn't it?
Right.
And Manasseh. They were the ones that had, they had their teeth sunk in it way back then.
Yes. And so Yahweh is used Ephraim to describe the religious mindset that is predicated upon, that claims that they are derived from the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So if you look at the Christian New Testament, the Christian Bible, what is it preceded by? What's the first three quarters of the Christian Bible?
The Torah.
Yahweh's word.
Right. You're right. The Torah prophet.
Well, it's not. It's not Yahweh's words. It's Yahweh's words twisted in such a bunch that nobody can make that.
But of course. But aren't they claiming that that the God of Christianity is the same God who spoke the Torah prophets and Psalms?
Yep. That's what they do. That's authority.
And they walked right away, wide away from it because of Paul's writings. They just walked away from it. And so Christianity claims its authority based upon the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And so they are perfectly represented by Ephraim. So here's Yahweh at a time when Ephraim no longer existed, using the term Ephraim to describe something prophetically. And what was he describing prophetically that would be like Ephraim, that would be of significance? There's only two candidates in the world.
Christianity and
Judaism.
Paul.
And
Judaism both. Yeah, Judaism is just so rotten to the core. I mean, a larger percentage.
It's the Torah, you know. It claims that it's that Moshe was a prophet. It makes the same claims as does Christianity. So it, too, walked out of and away from the truth.
Yep.
So it's religions that cover up and are predicated on the truth, that corrupts the truth and create false gods. That's Ephraim. So you're dealing directly with Christianity and Judaism. And to the extent that you can count Islam credible, it's large, but it claims to be Abrahamic.
Mm-hmm.
It claims that that its Quran affirms the Torah.
I think there were a certain percentage of family, as in Yehuda, as in, you know, Yisrael, that actually became Islamic. I do believe that. I think the two are one. I think, you know, when you talk about the, you know, Lord Baal and Sin, the moon god, they were right there in Babylon. And I think the two in the end are going to merge, just like they were there in Babylon. I think, what's his name with his Chrislam church? He's going to be right there at the center of it all, you know.
Yeah. Right? So then the flowers, desirability, and honor foolishly fades away, which beneficially, by way of the relationship, was first and foremost a valley of olives. And yet it will become struck down with intoxication. All right, so the first statements, they were all right in your face. All you got to do is look up the words. If you look up the words and you know what the words mean, you make the connections, it's right in your face. God's saying that religion is arrogant, that religion intoxicates, that religion establishes human authority and power, and that power is presumptive. And that it's really bad, and that he's providing a warning that we don't engage in something that's really bad. So that's right in your face. Just understand the words literally. He is now going over exactly the same turf, repeating only one word, and the word that he's repeating, he chose a different word for intoxication. But now what he's doing is he's presenting the same thing symbolically. And I think this, that when you combine blunt in your face with symbolism, and you attack the and expose and condemn this religious institution both ways, then you have the highest likelihood of those who are observant coming to understand. So he begins the flower. Now, is he talking about flowers?
No.
He's talking about things that look beautiful. That's what he's okay. talking about.
So he's thinking about something that is associated with the flower. So if the Hebrew word is T-S-Y-T-S. So if the signpost that is established by the hand of Yahweh specifically related to that upright pillar. So the upright pillar and signpost that is established by the very hand of God, the flower. Now, we talked about this today. The flower has two functions as it relates to the plant. Almost everybody that looks at the plant considers the flower the most attractive part of the plant, right? Mm-hmm. And it's really important to be attractive to God, because if you're not attractive to God, you're not going to be part of the covenant. And there's a really way to be. I mean, we're not trying to win a popularity contract. We're not trying to be pretty. There's a way to be unattractive to God, and there's a way to be attractive to God. And it's very simple. How do you become attractive to God?
Covenant.
You covenant. In the garment of light.
Right.
You join up. Yeah. That's the garment of light, man. That's that outfit.
Makes
that,
it pretty. Right. Makes
yeah,
it
pretty. Sure.
And the only way that you can adorn the garment of light is to accept the terms and conditions of the covenant and to attend Yahweh's invitations to meet with him, and you are afforded and adorned in the garment of light. You look beautiful in Yahweh's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
How do you look ugly? In fact, what do you have to do to appear to God as if you have dung all over your face? Which is pretty ugly.
Fighting.
Be religious.
Be religious. Mm-hmm. Be opposed to him through religion. If you're religious, God thinks you're ugly. So the flower is the most important part of the plant from a point of view of attractiveness. And this is saying the attractiveness of those who are religious was squandered. But the flower forms another function on a plant. It's the sex organ. It is the sex organ of a plant. It's the reproductive aspect of a plant. Plant's flower is where they seed, and it's what's pollinated. A flower literally is the reproductive part of a plant.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. So, if your flower is being rendered dysfunctional, where you are no longer capable of reproduction, and you were part of the covenant, and the entire covenant was about the seed, the reproductive nature of children being born into Yahweh's family because their parents shared the Torah with them. And that every aspect of the covenant was based on children born into Yahweh's family and them gaining an inheritance. And now he's talking about the reproductive part of a plant and saying it's dysfunctional. It's saying that your children aren't going to be part of the covenant. You are incapable now of being an heir to the covenant or having your children be heirs to the covenant.
Yeah, and Yahweh also talks about, you know, when he's talking about the end there, when you know, the the Third World War starts, and he's talking to these very people. He uses that same flower. He goes, your garden's full of flowers, and all this. They're going to be trampled down. I mean, there's going to be nothing there. I mean, it's the same group. And that same group is very well represented by, religion and most assuredly Christianity.
Yeah. We also talked about this today. What is the most famous of all flowers?
The rose.
The rose. Rose. And there is something about a rose, and everyone that's ever grown roses knows this. What happens if you don't clip back a spent rose?
They stop growing roses. I learned that one the hard way.
That is correct. They go to seed, they stop growing roses. And so if you don't clip the rose, prune it, let's say circumcise it at the sex origin, organ of the plant, the reproductive part of the plant, it stops producing roses, flowers.
Kind of interesting. Yeah, that's a good point.
Where are we circumcised as the sign of the covenant?
Right there at the sex organ.
Right. Yeah. The reproductive aspect of our nature. Correct?
Yeah.
So the flowers are really a nice metaphor for all of this. And the Hebrew word T-S-Y-T-S, it doesn't just speak of the attractive and reproductive part of the plant. It speaks of that which flourishes and shines. That which results in the derivative, if you will, of an engraved inscription of faces that are gleaming and eyes that are sparkling. Ever just find something that is tantalizing, that's informative, that's enlightening in Yahweh's words? Don't your eyes twinkle, your face shine?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And it, this tist word also speaks of salt, which preserves food, and of wings, which enable flight. All good things. So you're beautiful. You're capable of reproduction. You're capable of flourishing, of shining, of sparkling, of paying attention to an engraved inscription, of gleaming. Of being, of preserving that which is nutritious and taking flight.
And that's how I always picture Kirk and JB, too.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
That's my picture of them, too. Yeah, I put you in that same group, Larry. Shiny. And now it goes on and uses another adjective, because this other adjective is helps to emphasize this. It says, so then the flower, and so that you don't for a moment think he's talking about a plant. He's saying that it's beauty and honor. Has there ever been an honorable plant? No, he speaks of growth and glory. Has there ever been a glorious plant? He speaks of splendor and prominence. Is there a plant that has prominence? He says, he speaks of attractiveness and appeal. Well, there's plants that would have both of those. Ability to reach out, stretching out one's hand. Plants don't have hands. Okay. There are two aspects that are being conveyed here, and they are both linked to the covenant. As the covenant's children, we are desirable to God. We are attractive to God. But also, we have prominence with God. We have we are glorified by God. We appear splendorous. So we gain a status with God as His children, and are beautified by Him through the set apart Spirit as a garment of light. And so this flower's beauty, its desirability, its honor, and its status were Nabal. Were foolishly given away, dishonored and disgraced, because those who were intoxicated became senseless. They treated Yahweh's testimony with disgrace and with contempt, and therefore were rejected. They languished, in other words, they were apathetic, and therefore they withered and shriveled away. They were played for fools, and stupidly became worthless. Wow.
You know, Nabal, the word right after Nabal is Nabalah with a H, and you add the hay, and it becomes a carcass.
Yeah.
A man's carcass, so you have a human symbol at the end.
Yeah, all you're doing in the end of it is you're making it feminine, and you're Nabal as Nabala becomes a carcass.
Yeah.
So what happens is a carcass a dead animal? And so it's an animal that the soul no longer exists, right? So if you have become intoxicated by religious institutions and the haughtiness and the leadership and the presumptiveness of religious institutions, then you have squandered your soul. You are dead.
So,
what is your you know?
Right?
This oil painting sounds like the Ars Cola.
Yeah.
All right. Comparing Satan with, I look at Yah as being his creators, and the topic that Yah had brought up the other day with our artist, he's done a cover for the book.
Okay.
I really enjoyed that.
So here we have, so the flower's desirability and honor foolishly fades away as squandered because you're played for a fool. And then what he's saying, which beneficially, by way of relationship, was first and foremost, a valley of olives will be overcome and be struck down with intoxication. So we have the attractiveness, the splendor and the beauty, the rank and the renown. The ornamentation, which would be the set-apart spirit's garment of light, of the flower is now gone. And yet that was, beneficially, by way of relationship, the first and foremost design of Yahweh. For Ephraim and Yisrael to be a valley of olives. Now, do you think, have you ever seen a valley of olives? I never have.
No.
So what do you think he's talking about when he says his first priority was for Ephraim to be a valley of olives?
I think that that's represented by his set-apart spirit, the Ruach, which is the other form of air we could be dealing with other than spirits.
So he says, first and foremost, it was my plan that Ephraim, representing either 10 or 11 of the tribes, depending on the timing that you consider Ephraim, whether or not it included Benjamin or not, it eventually came to include Benjamin. He's saying that Ephraim, first and foremost, was to be a conduit of the Spirit, of enlightenment, of healing, of nourishment, and of life, of everything the olive represents in throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
The Ruach Kodesh.
Right. The olive tree is the oldest, longest-lived tree in that part of the world.
Yep.
Long and enduring life.
And it provided nurturing and nutrition.
Right. The olive was among the most nurturing, nutritious foods you could eat.
Yeah.
The olive provided the purest light to pierce the darkness, to enlighten. And the ancient world.
The menorah, olive was, as an example.
Yeah, the olive was the oil for the menorah. And I asked Kurt today, I said, Kurt, the top, the luminaries of the menorah, what were they designed to look like? The olive gave very specific instructions. What was the tip of the menorah designed to look like?
It was a flower.
A flower. And so he's talking about their flower no longer exists. And that it's no longer a conduit for the olive.
Mm-hmm.
He's speaking that they were to be part of the menorah. You know, that they were amongst those six candles on the side of the menorah that were where the flower was the very place where the olive oil light was conducted up and through, illuminating and sharing the nature of Yahweh and his 6+1 plan. Well, the Valley of Olives is a conduit for everything that is associated with the Spirit. Nourishment, life, enlightenment, and healing.
It, you know what else it means?
What?
Eight.
It means what?
Eight. The number eight.
Oh, German. Okay. Oh, yeah.
And also, and then we talk about fat as in fat being enriched or enlaged.
Yeah,
let's talk about
eight first. Why is eight important as it relates to a conduit for eight? What would a conduit for eight mean?
Conduit for a way to make it through eternity, to make it to eternity.
Right. So Ephraim, as representing either 10 or the 11 tribes, was originally first and foremost as part of Yahweh's covenant plan to be a conduit to make us immortal.
I believe that's 10, by the way, there at that point, because I do believe that Benjamin and Loewy went with Yehuda. That's what I think.
But Benjamin immediately thereafter turned against Yehuda.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying
that.
So but
it depends at the time. If you're looking at the time of Hosea, Ephraim represented 10 of the 12 tribes. Mm-hmm. At the time of this communication and thereafter.
That could have well been.
Yeah, except from Benjamin joined in the hate of Yehuda and therefore became part of that. But eight is the symbol for eternity. It means of being immortal.
And this is why the eighth day you're circumcised, which is you circumcise your child. This is why there's
the
eighth day in Sukkah, a set apart.
Right, camping out with God of eternity.
Sure.
And so they were a conduit to the everlasting. Now, fat. Shaman can be translated olives and olive oil, or it can be translated fat. And we talked a little bit about fat before the show ended, and then we almost said nothing about it that we would linger on and talk about it this evening. But what did fat mean then versus now? The reason why don't we talk about fat now, but fat was a good thing then?
Well, it represented wealth. It was a good thing. It was a good
thing.
We were overfed.
Right.
Now.
If you had an abundance of things, if you were productive, if you were someone who harvested sufficient crops, then you were not skinny, but instead fat. A person who had an abundance was fat as opposed to skinny. If you were skinny, it was typically a sign that you were malnourished. So fat meant something positive then as opposed to something negative. Now, with the second aspect of fat. If you lived in Alaska, or you lived in a cold climate, and you were given something to eat, and let's say you were given walrus to eat or whale to eat, what would be the most warming and nourishing, the most energy-providing aspect of the meat? The fat or the what we consider the fleshy meat?
It'd be the blubber. It'd be the fat.
If anytime you go to a survivalist kind of a show, in fact, if you watch any of the survivalist shows, they always go to the fat. Because the fat provides more energy, more nourishment, more warmth. The reason that we don't think of fat favorably today is because our diets are so rich in it. So, we have so much processed foods that, fat, too much fat is a problem. But some fat is extremely beneficial.
Well, we still have idioms like living off the fat of the land, things like that.
Right,
I mean,
it is the fat of the land that allows us
to do that.
Right. If your fat speaks of growing, if you're not growing, you're dying. So there were aspects of fat in that day that were spoke of things which people, almost everybody would have seen as beneficial, where today we don't see fat as beneficial or attractive. That was untrue at the time that this was written. So I just, personally, I don't disregard the benefits of fat. I just don't emphasize them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so much of a different connotation now. You lose your audience.
Well, it's the fat of the land.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
That's where taking in a productive society from Pelagius governmental type places, from one person giving to another at the point of a gun, which is considered somehow moral today, is just living off the fat of the land. And, of course, they do that until the cow's dead.
Right.
But, you know.
Right.
Sure.
Okay. Then when you enter Yahweh's covenant family, you are given an abundance of everything. You don't want for anything. And so you grow. So you're well nourished. So, you know, we're going to be able to eat whatever we want to eat and not ever grow out of shape. You know, it's...
I like that. I hope there's a Krispy Kreme up there, you know.
There you go. Now, so what this says is that the flower, the reproductive nature, and the attractiveness, the desirability, and the honor was rejected. Faded away into oblivion because of the stupidity and worthless nature of the people. And then its attractiveness, which by relationship was first and foremost a result of this conduit for the Spirit and all the benefits associated with the Spirit and eternity. And it says, will be overcome and struck down, trampled into submission with intoxication. So Yahweh is speaking of the means and the method.
And then that word halam related to halal.
All right. Absolutely. So the thing that does us in is indoctrination, is intoxication, is the inability to exercise good judgment. It's drinking the Kool-Aid of patriotism and religion and politics, where they would tell you that hate speech is bad, where being judgmental is bad, where being discriminating is bad, where with political correctness, lies are more appropriate.
Sterile conversations where nobody questions anything. I mean, that sums up political correctness. I mean, it's designed to limit speech to begin with.
Right. So those indoctrinated, intoxicated by religion and politics and academia and political correctness and the media and all of that sort of thing, the Yahweh says, they're just perfect. I really like those elitists who are enlightened, who are politically correct and are not judgmental. No, he says, they're struck down.
There's a big part of Christianity and also, you know, Buddhism and others, where everything is accepted. I mean, everything.
Right. Everything.
In other words, they've inculcated within their religious matrix the political correctness.
Correct. Well, how did Christianity grow? Wasn't Christianity
by incorporating
of all religions?
Yeah, it's an amalgamation of all the religions, basically.
Right. Right.
That had to do with sun worship, for sure.
Well, now,
earth worship, too. And earth worship, too, because the Druids did that. I mean, after all, Hesus is their man, you know.
Right.
Tell me something. You've got three of the biggest religions in the world. You've got Christianity, Islam, and social secular humanism is most definitely a made-up religion. And none of them are creative. They're all, and just like Satan, is not creative. He cannot come up with anything new. All it can do is twist. And they all have to rely on some deep-rooted thing. People that were deep-rooted into Christianity or something, they wound up with social secular humanism. Christianity had to rely on Judaism, and Islam had to rely on the Talmud to begin with and twist it. Or, you know, so it's like, shouldn't that tell you something? That none of them can come up with anything creative at all?
Right.
Well, nothing that looks real on their own. I mean, go ahead, I'm sorry.
All of them are sold based upon there is a severe consequence of disagreeing with them. Particularly secularism. Oh, man, they're just wholly and completely vicious and intolerant.
Oh, yeah.
But they're all sold the same way. They impose their will the same way, that by fear. If you are a heretic. If you dare speak the truth, if you expose them, they'll come at you. And their attack is fearsome.
Yeah, religious spirit is a vicious one. I want to point something out here. You know, that there's a lot of course, on social media, there's a lot of different people that put information out. One of the things that Halal Ben-Shakar did was have a dead body rise up out of the ground in many of his counterfeits.
Right.
And they want to, of course, use this as an example why none of this is true.
Yeah.
Well,
Zionism,
first of all, we know a dead body.
Right. Osiris.
Never did.
Yep.
And we know none of that happened. And we also know that Yahusha didn't do that. It was snappish meeting back up with that olive spirit there. And that's what worked. It had nothing to do with a zombie walking around that had been filleted along.
I would tell you, we said the other day that I'd rather be right than good.
That was a profound statement. And of course, that is
right. Why would you want your physical body to be resurrected? I'd rather be rid of it.
I'd rather be able to do
it. I don't want this body right now.
No. Goodness gracious, it's so limiting. I mean, why would you want all of the limitations?
You're not
going to
travel at the speed of a light, pal.
With a physical body.
You're right.
Yeah. You can't be
amplified. I'd rather be amplified, sure. But I wanted to point out there is not just the 3-day thing. It's that the morons that put this stuff out don't realize that, you know, Ha-Satan doesn't live in the normal flow of time either. So when he develops his counterfeits, he can see in advance what happened. And so he can, you know, he can use those to mislead people. He misleads in every which way he can. But I just want to put that out there.
Yeah. I think, we know that Ha-Satan is immortal. I'm not certain that Ha-Satan is given the same access in terms of maneuverability in time that we will be given and that Yahweh has. Just because he is a spirit, I'm not certain. I think Yahweh put constraints on Ha-Satan. Like, you know, he didn't allow Ha-Satan initially into the garden, but then, you know, let him in.
It's just like when he was going to torment Job. He had to have permission. He doesn't have the same power.
Right. So I don't think he has the same power. I think he'd do a much better job. Well, part of me says he'd do a much better job and be more creative if he had the ability to maneuver in time, because he would see what worked and what didn't work. But part of what makes Satan do what he does is that, first and foremost, it's not just that Satan wants to be considered God and above Yahweh. It's that Satan is pissed off that Yahweh likes and loves mankind. Because
how can you pay attention to worms when you
feel jealous? Why is God so fascinated with this inferior being? So what does he do? He's finally trying to show Yahweh that this being that Yahweh is so devoted to, that has made so many tremendous sacrifices on behalf of, is so enamored with, that being is really stupid and worthless. And what better way to show that humanity is stupid and worthless than to fool men and women with stupid and worthless, ridiculous religions? So I think that's a significant part of why religions are all the same and why they are so stupid. Is that Yahweh is showing us that these things are stupid. So the next statement goes on to say, pay attention. All right, so this is Hannah. Hina is amongst the most revealing words in the totality of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. What Hina conveys is look up, be aware, behold, pay attention. So there's a difference between Hina and Hoy. Both of them mean pay attention. But one is, I'm giving you a warning about something that's really bad. Hina is typically used of pay attention. I'm going to share something with you that's really good. All right? So henna is the person reaching up to Yahweh, where oi is the person walking away from him. All right? So pay attention. Henna. Behold. Look and see. One who is restored by being uncompromising and is also steadfast approaches Yahweh. All right, so Yahweh is like a good father. He's telling you, you know, if you do these things, the result is going to be bad. These things will have consequences, and the consequences are really bad. Just, I'm warning about them. But it's one thing to say, Kirk, we talked about this a couple of days ago, it's to say religion bad, politics bad, militarism bad, patriotism bad. Okay, those things are bad. So then what?
Yahweh
never leaves you with then what?
No.
No matter where he's talking, no matter what the conversation is, he always says, so this is what's good. So what's good? Those who pay attention. They are restored.
The ones that are right.
Right. Yeah. They're restored by being uncompromising. They prevail by being firm, resolute, rigid, and right. And they grow strong. And they are
empowered. Sometimes that isn't easy, by the way, regardless of your emotions. Right. To stand on what's right is to stand on what's right. I mean, I've had to do things I wasn't particularly pleased with having to do, but I did them because, you know, that was standing on the truth. And I, you know, sometimes it's pretty unpopular, by the way, you know.
Yeah. So if you want to be restored, be uncompromising. If you want to be politically correct, be compromising. If you want to fit in to political correctness and socialist secular humanism, be compromising. If you want to be considered a good Christian, be tolerant. If you want to be considered restored by Yahweh, be exactly the opposite. Be rigid and uncompromising. That's what Yahweh says. What does Yahweh mean? To dig in one's heels.
Digging his heels.
A person who digs in their heels is going to be pulled right one side or the other. They're resolute. They're uncompromising. Pay attention. The one who is restored by being uncompromising and also steadfast and bold, blunt. You know, you're pretty uncompromising. You know, all these people that you know you originally encouraged, and they began to say and share things that were truthful, and then they go off to Torah means law, and that they go to the this notion that God wants to be feared and obeyed and all that kind of rubbish. And what you say is goodbye. I don't want anything to do with you. I'm going to try to help you. I'm going to try to correct what you're saying. But ultimately, you know, goodbye. And so what he's saying here is that not only do you have to be uncompromising, because Yahweh is uncompromising, but you also have to be steadfast and bold, just blunt. If somebody is going to say something that's untrue, try to correct them. If they're not going to accept correction, then just walk away.
Right. That's exactly what I do. Yeah, I mean, we're watchmen if we're alive. I mean, if we're going to be in a, we're watchmen. And so if somebody begins, you know, pulling others down or trying to pull anyone down around you, then they got to be gone, because we're moving further into the Torah. If you've noticed this every year, I'm sure noticed. We go further and further and further into Yahweh's words, and we get more and more Torah, and we embrace it. At some point, you know, you're looking back, and I realize people don't know what maybe you know, or maybe JB knows, even what I know, or Kirk knows, they should know enough when it's being presented to them in a very fair manner that they can easily see.
Correct.
If they choose to
get it right away, or they just don't seem to. I mean, right.
They don't want to.
Yeah,
they don't want to.
For all the reasons they don't. They either just don't. But the ones that get it, just, boy, they just jump right in with both feet.
Oh, you ain't kidding. And they're there. It's so funny, man. I've watched people develop in a week, 2 weeks. The ones that don't are the ones that question everything. And I'll tell you what they do with me is they send me cheap websites with words like, Mashiach! You know, and people dressed in religious.
What they're looking for is truth in lots of different places. And you finally say, no, truth only comes from one place.
You're
going to some place that is not going to focus on the Word of Yahweh and talk about the Word of Yahweh and what the words mean.
And
you reveal them. And dig into them, then you're going to be led astray. We don't want anything to do with you. So if you just want to send me to a website or refer a website where somebody's got some agenda, some group, No. Go. If that's what you want, stay there. If you're
Take that 2,500 pages that I sent you and just lose them because I guess you're not going to read them.
Yeah. Right. Now, this word here that Yahweh has chosen, I think, defines to a large degree who we are. It's emet. It means adamant and inflexible. Man, if there's anything that's really important, and it says that pay attention, the ones who are uncompromising, adamant, and inflexible approach Yahweh. So, political correctness, no way. A tolerant, all-loving God, no way. All paths lead to God, no way.
You know, Fred had written something in a post, and you know, it's kind of a call out to him. He said when he first saw your material, he was going into the Yada forum site, and he went in there with the idea of, well, I just want to kick this guy's ass. You know, and after a couple of weeks of reading it, he realized he was reading reality. See, he went in there with the idea his mother had died, and how dare anyone say his mother was dead? She has to be in heaven somewhere, strumming harp strings or whatever. And then... I guess that's, from a Christian standpoint, that's all you're doing. So it's, I'd rather be dead personally. But anyway, the bottom line is, his wife started reading because he couldn't put it down. And it went on for a couple of weeks. And then he said he came to know not only was his mother dead, you know, and this is no victory, but I mean, it's a victory in his way of thinking. But almost everybody he ever met was dead, if not all.
Right.
And that's what you got to finally approach this at. You're going for the words. It's not a matter of correcting, as you put it somewhere, Craig, spilled milk. I mean, you just can't.
Right. You know, since there's nothing you can do about it, and since those who were victims of religion aren't suffering, since they're not in hell, since there's no suffering whatsoever, since you have the fond memories of them, and since they are experiencing no anguish whatsoever, at that point, there's only one thing that you ought to be concerned about, learning the truth yourself so that you don't make the same mistakes, so that you don't squander your soul, and you ought to have several motivations from doing that. One is that you ought to care enough about who the Creator is to actually get to know Him. Number two, you ought to care about your own soul sufficiently that you want to know what He's offering. And number three, you ought to care enough about your children and your loved ones to share with them what you've learned. And
you're here.
That's the reason that for someone to say, you know, I'm not going to accept what Yahweh says because religion promised me that my loved one would be in heaven, and you're telling me they're not.
Yeah, they lied to me.
And I'm telling you, they lied to you. And so, now that you know they lied to you, do you want to side with the liars? Do you want to continue to be in the group of liars? Do you want to continue to believe the people who lied to you? Or are you going to be angry with them? You're going to reject
them.
You're going to walk away.
Should be pissed. Everybody I ever knew died because of them. Anyway,
right.
I mean, that's
right.
The truth.
Absolutely. Every single one died because of them. And if it doesn't piss you off, then you don't have a conscience. Then you're incapable of exercising good judgment. So
or compassion. Or
that,
compassion.
Right. But Yahweh is telling us that the intoxicating influence of the authorities over religion and politics, who are presumptive and arrogant, that they are of Ephraim, and that the attractiveness of the individuals who succumb to them, who are indoctrinated by them, fades off to oblivion because they're played for fools. And then he says, if you want to approach me, Yahweh says, those who pay attention approach me. Those who are restored by being uncompromising approach me. Those who are adamant and inflexible approach me. Now, do you think that just being adamant and inflexible, paying attention and being uncompromising is sufficient to find yourself in Yahweh's presence? Or is he speaking of recognizing that his guidance, his Torah, is what you have to pay attention to, and you have to realize that he only provides one way, that he is holy and tolerant and inflexible?
I think it might include his plan, his mishpat. I think so.
Yeah, what are you paying attention to? You know, Dr. Hanna, pay attention.
I mean, you could have people in business and uncompromising wouldn't have anything to do with this. Sure.
Yeah, how would you come to recognize that Ephraim represents institutionalized religion, false gods, if you didn't pay attention to what Yahweh had to say in the book of Hosea?
Yeah. If you don't go to the Torah, you can't find any of this.
Right. And when you read Hosea speaking of Ephraim being divorced from Yahweh because they rejected the terms and conditions of the covenant and that they were not his children, do you find a God who is tolerant and acceptive, or a God that's adamant and inflexible and uncompromising?
He didn't take me there.
That's a bit of compromising.
One road.
Right. So if you want to approach Yahweh, come to know who he is, what he's offering, and accept it on his terms as someone who recognizes that Yahweh is adamant, inflexible, and uncompromising, and that is the means to restoration. Now, he didn't say that the religious was of Jacob, who dug at his heels, who was uncompromising. He said that religion is of Ephraim. And Ephraim accepted all religions and worshipped all false gods. So this is the means to come to know Yahweh.
Yeah, I mean, there's no other way to do it. Look, if he told me go up there and drink that 8-ounce glass of water that's got a little bit of lemon in it, and you're going to come to get to know me, I'd go do it. And then if somebody else came along and said, you don't have to drink the water. Drink a root beer instead, man. It tastes a lot better.
Yeah.
Who should I listen to?
So what follows here is really interesting. Now, Yahweh is making a contrast. There's those who are restored by being uncompromising, adamant and inflexible. Dug in, if you will. Jacob. They approach Yahweh. He says, so in a manner similar to a downpour, with hail, a storm which separates and divides, like a flood, waters great and powerful, they wash away. Now, aren't there two ways to be washed away? Now, he's talking about Ephraim, that they're washed away. He is going to...
You can be washed away in a flood, and it's not a good thing.
Right. And so he's telling us that yes, Ephraim's going to be washed away. It's going to be a giant downpour, and he's going to cleanse the earth, and he's going to wash away all religious and political influence. And that's the prophetic statement. But, you know, we also can be washed, and our sin can go away. In a downpour, in a outpouring of living waters and cleansing waters from Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So these great and powerful waters that Yahweh provides creates this distinction and separation. On one side, they're cleansing and separating unto Yahweh, and those same waters wash away all of the ugliness, all of the things that we despise and that God despises in religion and politics. You know, would the 1,000 years, that's a long time, 1,000 years, that we're going to spend celebrating Sukkah, year 6,000 to 7,000, what if Yahweh didn't wash away all religious influence? Would it be miserable?
Yeah, because that's a long misery.
Right. And so we're going to be washed and cleansed by this outpouring of living waters and cleansing waters. But the same waters are going to wash away all political and religious and patriotic influences. So that we're in an environment that's clean and fun and healthy and enjoyable. So, yes.
Yeah. May I?
Sure.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
You mentioned Bob means to dig your heels. Is he the chap that wrestled with the Malak?
Well, I'm only getting like one out of every five words.
Who wrestled with the Malak? How would Jacob?
Yaakov, as I translated, this transition from Yaakov becoming Yisrael. The individual that I think that he wrestled with was Shakar, and it's presented as Shakar, and Halal bin Shakar, or Halal bin Shakar, depending on which of the two passages you're reading in Yashaya, defines Satan. And so was, I read the account of Yaakov and his transition from Yaakov to Yisrael, what I read is that that just as Yosha was offered everything that Satan could offer, and Satan has a lot of influence and power in this world, and how Hasatan tried to entice Yosha with all manner of things, and Yosha, after 40 days and 40 nights in wrestling with Hasatan, rejected him and said, go away, and he sent him away by reciting the words of Yahweh. I see Yaakov digging in his heels and rejecting the temptations that were being offered by Halel ben Shakar, and therefore Yahweh renamed him Yisrael, an individual who engages and endures with Yah, as a result of being offered and wrestling with the benefits associated, at least the ones that were proclaimed by Shakar, and saying, no, I reject them.
And does it say that it was his hip or something was put out of place?
I don't see any place where he was injured in the process. As I translated, I did not see any injury. I just see a wrestling, which is a tussling with. The story of Job is about wrestling with the claims of and the various torments of Hasatan. And Yosha did it.
Like religion.
Yaakov,
like we're talking.
Right. Yaakov did it. I think that Noah had to do it. Abram did it, Adam did it, and capitulated. Noah was influenced by that culture and rejected it. Shamuel was influenced by that culture and rejected it. Dode was enticed by it and rejected it. But Yaakov, absolutely. And, to a large extent, Abraham grew up in it. He had to reject it and walk away from it.
He was very old by the time he walked away, too.
Yeah, he was.
A lot of years.
Moshe was enticed by it, became part of it. And Moshe, even having had extraordinarily high status in Pharaoh's family, rejected it when he beat the Egyptian taskmaster to death because they were tormenting an innocent person.
Yeah.
So he rejected it. So I think there's a common thread amongst these giants of Yahweh's prophecy and story. And I think Yaakov's transition to Israel is the same thing. That's I know that my translation of it, reading of it, and interpretation of it is the opposite of what everybody else has come up with. So is there the possibility that I'm wrong? Yeah, but it's what makes sense to me. It's what the words say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One more question, if you would bear with me. It's literally to do, this Torah say any, I've been one, I kind of,
okay. Now
you're breaking up there.
Yeah, man. I'm only getting one out of every four or five words. So all I heard is the Torah say, and I didn't get the rest of it.
I didn't either.
Okay. I'll try and call back.
Okay. Yeah, right. I was unable to get any more than just the
Torah. Yeah, I'll try and call back on another phone.
Okay.
Okay.
But I think the story of Jacob makes no sense whatsoever. If he's wrestling with Yahweh or a diminished manifestation of Yahweh with Yahusha, why would you fight with God? You know, you don't become one who engages and endures with God by fighting with God. You do so by engaging, by accepting, by embracing, by listening to, by observing what he had to say. There is no circumstance where a person becomes a member of the covenant by fighting with God, by opposing him. Right? Just think about the silliness of the whole thing. How is it possible that a man is going to fight with God? You know,
I don't know. Ask the Greeks. Ask the Greeks. They've made that story up 100 times. Of course, it's nonsense. Sure.
Yeah. So I just see it as utter and complete nonsense that it isn't possible that anybody can fight with God. And so no, I don't buy it.
I believe he was wrestling with Halal Ben Shakar right there. You know, that's what I think was going on.
Sure. Well, it certainly says Shakar is the one that he was wrestling with. And
yeah, I don't think that Yahweh would associate himself with that word, to be honest with you. I really don't.
Yeah, you know, there is an implication and a connection between Yahweh and the brilliance of the sun, where Yahweh refers to himself as the greater luminary. The greater
Bereshit.
Right, in Bereshit. And there's places where we won't have need for the sun because Yahweh will be the light of the new Jerusalem. So there are places where he says, you know, this light and this warmth and this life-giving nature of the sun, you really ought to be associating with me and not with false gods. But the reality is that 99% of the references to Shakar are satanic because man's religions have consistently created false gods, with the top false god being the sun. That's why it's Halal or Halal ben Shakar, being Baal, the Lord, Satan. And that's why his name is as it is. So, but in that statement, particularly in the context of it, I don't see it as even being possible that there's any other rational interpretation of it than what the words seem to indicate, which is that he was wrestling with Satan, just as Yahusha was forced to do, as Moshe did, as Abraham did, as Noah did, as Doe did. You know, the influences of the world and all the enticing nature that the world has to offer. And, you know, ultimately you have to reject it if you're going to accept the Yahweh. Well, you know, I don't think I'm going to get...
Think about it, you know, Satan is Halal ben Shakar, you know, the sun, ben means sun, the son of. So
right.
He was wrestling with Satan is the son of, which is, well, not really son, but religion. You know, Shakar
right.
being just a, you know, representation of religion, period.
Right.
Not necessarily, well, Satan through religion, but,
right.
you know.
Yeah, at the time that was issued, there was no religion on earth where the sun was anything other than the chief deity.
Deity.
Yes. And every religion on earth, the sun represented the top deity. And so he is wrestling with the sun, the representative of the top deity in every pagan religion on earth, including the religion in Egypt where Amun-Ra is the sun. Baal is always the sun. The Lord is always the sun.
If you think about it, that relates back to all of us. Yeah, you know, we all wrestle with that on a daily basis in our lives because it's everywhere.
Right. And if you think about it too, the religion of Christianity, he is born on the winter solstice where the sun's influence on the days become greater. He dies and is resurrected on the vernal equinox, where the days and nights are of equal length, and when the sun causes the plants to be reborn each spring, there's exactly 9 months between them, which is the gestation period. It was born out of this notion of Eshtar, where the sun impregnated Semiramis, who is Astarte, who is Eshtar, who gave birth to the son of the sun, Ninus, Tammuz, Osiris, Dionysus, Bacchus, Jesus Christ, 9 months later on the winter solstice, December 25th. So, and the sun is in the constellation of Taurus the Bull, which is the principal sign and symbol of Baal. During the pagan celebration of Easter, halos and wreaths and crowns are all based on the roundness of the sun. The church is based upon the same word that is the circle, the daughter of Helios, the sun god. Today, Christianity, its trinity is based on the Babylonian sun god worship. It's holidays. And for God's sake, what is the day that Christians gather?
Sunday?
Sunday. Yeah, so it's ubiquitous. So the religion of Christianity has become a sun god religion. And the reason it became a sun god religion, it actually began that way.
It's a worship of a Lord on Sunday, which would be a good thing to throw in there. And the cross was his most important symbol. I have to say that if there's worship, and of course we all know that, but if there's worship involved, because I see so much of this, you might be worshiping the wrong God. Well, if you're worshiping at all,
you're worshiping the wrong God.
Right.
Yeah.
Yahweh doesn't accept
worship. God that wants
to
be worshipped is a God not worth knowing.
That's right.
Yeah. And the whole concept from Constantine through Theodosius, which is this transition where the evil Roman Empire became the evil Roman Catholic Church. That transition is based solely on the transformation of this religion of Christianity to embrace all things that were practiced in the religion of Rome, which was sun god worship. You know, Jupiter. They became Zeus, you know, and it's all based upon the sun. You know, what is the light that you see on the planet Jupiter or Mars or Mercury? I know all Roman gods.
Reflection of the sun.
Reflection of the sun. All of us. Yeah, so the primary religion of the emperors and their legions at the time that Christianity emerged from Roman, the Empire of Rome, Imperial Rome, was there one religion under two different names. One was Sol Invicticus, which means the unconquerable sun, and the other was Mithraism, where Mithras was the sun. And in fact, in Mithraism, you even have all of the accoutrements of the son of the sun. And the cult of Mithraism, the cult of the unconquerable sun, is indistinguishable from Christianity as it's practiced today, because that's how Roman Catholicism emerged from the Roman Empire.
Yeah, it was the religion of the Roman legion. So if you wanted to win Rome, you had to incorporate it somehow.
Well, to be the emperor and pope of Imperial Rome, you had to have larger and more deadly legions loyal to you than to your rival. And so you absolutely endorsed and embraced the religion of your legions. That was the only way you made them. And you presented yourself as the living embodiment of the deity of your legions. So how the whole thing worked.
Yep.
So that's how Christianity was formed. That's why it's so rotten. Well, fellas, it's been fun. We've covered a lot of turf tonight over the last 2 hours. I want to thank you.
Been a slice as far as I'm concerned. Great show. I'm glad you went ahead and sort of replayed it for those of us who couldn't get in there.
Kirk, my guess is that about half of what we said was mentioned, and about half of what we said is beyond what we talked about. And so it's all growing, and the more times you go over the same material, the more it becomes integrated. You know, when Yahweh says, I'm going to write my Torah inside of you, the more you go over his teaching, the more it incorporated into your very nature.
Oh, yeah, the more you share the
best. We talked about with, chewing the cud.
Exactly, chewing the cud.
Chew it, swallow it, bring it back, right. Chew it some more.
Right. That's the way Yahweh teaches. And I was, James, I was listening to Scott today, was talking about Larry. He says, that Larry is, when Scott engages you on Facebook and that sort of thing, he says, he just knows the right statement from Yahweh to use at almost every occasion because he's done it so much. And the more you do it, the more it becomes part of the fabric of your lives. That's why when you were talking about the golden calf, James, and you wrote me contemporaneous with the show, you said, there's something about this golden calf that you ought to consider. When you go over the material and you think about it and you chew it and you regurgitate it and you chew it some more, it instantly becomes the part of the fabric of your life. It's the perspective from which you view things. And so your insights were profound. That's how we get there. Yeah. That's what it means to closely examine and carefully consider.
That's what makes it fun.
It's what makes it fun.
Listen, I sent you over an email. If you would, when you have no more than 5 minutes is all it's going to take. Shoot me over your phone number so I can buzz. I'd shoot you over mine, but I have my phones turned off on the weekends, and I don't carry a cell phone. If I turned it on, I'd have people calling in, wanting engines all day.
I
don't want that.
All right. Yeah, it's at this point, the only phone that I'm using when I'm in Ohio is my cell phone. So I'll share that with you. I don't give it off very often, so I will. But I'll give it to you. We'll keep it a quiet thing.
Just shoot it over in an email.
Okay. All right. Good enough. Good night.
Appreciate it.
You guys have a good weekend.
You too. Bye bye.